Welcome to Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with the faculty of a recent Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinar on sarcoma, hosted by Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center. At the meeting, faculty shared updates in the management of gastrointestinal stromal tumor, epithelioid and synovial sarcoma, and tenosynovial giant cell tumor. First, we spoke with the chair of the meeting, Jonathan C. Trent, MD, PhD, Professor and Associate Director for Clinical Research at the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Miami Health System.
Historically, GIST has been treated by imatinib, sunitinib, and regorafenib. Imatinib provides a 24-month median progression-free survival, whereas sunitinib, a 6-month median progression-free survival, and regorafenib provides about a 4-month progression-free survival for patients with metastatic GIST. There are two new agents that have recently been FDA approved, ripretinib and avapritinib. Ripretinib seems to also provide about a 6-month median progression-free survival for patients who have been treated with second line or greater of therapy. Avapritinib for metastatic GIST patients in general did not provide much benefit in PFS and was not FDA approved against regorafenib in a randomized study. However, avapritinib is exceptionally effective at GIST caused by PDGF receptor D842V. This mutation is resistant to all other tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So the fact that we finally have an agent that is effective against this patient is remarkable. And it's as effective as imatinib is against KIT mutant GIST, providing what looks like going to be a long median progression-free survival, probably going to end up being around 2 years also. This is very important for these patients because they've had no other effective therapy. The other important breakthrough that is emerging in GIST is the utility of circulating tumor DNA. Circulating tumor DNA is a non-invasive test with a rapid turnaround time, often in a week. And this provides us information about the primary mutation and any resistance mutations that might have emerged after the patient was treated with imatinib. Understanding the primary mutation that's driving the GIST is important because there's actually somewhere around 10 different GIST subtypes, not just KIT mutant GIST, but PDGFR, alpha, GIST that's driven by NF1 or neurofibromatosis, GIST that can be driven by RAF mutation, SDH loss, etc. One has to understand the primary mutation in order to match the therapy to the patient. For instance, if the patient has a RAF mutant GIST, why would you treat them with a KIT inhibitor? You wouldn't. You would treat them with a RAF inhibitor. And so understanding the primary driver mutation is critical. Understanding the resistance mutations is also becoming important. For instance, patients who become resistant to imatinib, the tumor cells retain the original KIT exon 11 mutation, but there is selective pressure, and what emerges are resistance mutations in either exon 13 or exon 17. These resistance mutations are different, and there's heterogeneous activity of subsequent lines of KIT inhibitors against these resistance mutations. For instance, sunitinib and probably ripretinib are active against KIT exon 13 mutations. The exon 17 resistance mutations, on the other hand, are resistant to sunitinib but sensitive to other kinase inhibitors such as avapritinib, regorafenib. So you can see that when a patient becomes resistant to imatinib, you can understand what's driving their resistance by circulating tumor DNA. This is our standard practice at Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center. And then once we understand the driver resistance mutation, we treat the patient with the optimal therapy that has the most activity against that driver mutation. And we really think that this is the best way to manage patients. And we hope that a prospective trial to validate this approach will be performed in the near future.
We were then joined by Aditi Dheer, MD, Assistant Professor of Clinical Pediatrics in the Division of Hematology Oncology at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. To start off, you know, of course, these are very rare cancers. A lot of physicians, I'm sure, don't see a lot of them. So what would you say is sort of the prevalence of these cancers among patients?
Sarcomas in general are very rare. They're a very small proportion of cancers in both pediatrics and adults. So if you look at the data from the SEER group from like 2013-2017, the rate of new soft tissue sarcomas is just about 3.5 per 100,000 in both men and women per year. Epithelioid and synovial sarcomas are actually both even a smaller subset of these cancers. So epithelioid sarcoma is seen in like less than 1% of the adult cancers and 4-8% of the pediatric cancers. And then synovial sarcomas is seen in like about 9% of the soft tissue sarcomas in less than 20 years. So basically both of them are very rare. But what's really unique for both of them is that they sort of peak in the AYA age group, which is our adolescent and young adults age group. So sort of the peak incidence is about second or third decade of life.
With this rarity, diagnosing obviously becomes kind of a challenge just because maybe people aren't seeing it, so they're not knowing exactly what to look out for. So what are some of the nuances that come with diagnosing these malignancies?
A lot of sarcomas, despite the aggressive behavior, can be very slow growing. They're like rooted in the deeper tissues, and it's a while before these lumps and bumps come into notice, as they usually are like painless. So based on like literature, the average time to diagnosis for sarcomas can range from like a few months to even a year based on the location and the associated symptoms, just because we tend to ignore these. The point that I do want to highlight though is when possible to diagnose these, a core biopsy should be obtained. A lot of times we end up getting like an excisional biopsy without knowing the true extent of the disease. And this results in like incomplete resection or sometimes a positive surgical margin. And this can really influence treatment.
So then moving into treatment options, what options are available to patients? And if you want to touch on, you know, surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, and anything else that is being used for these malignancies.
Just like any other sarcoma, we try to use like a multimodal approach. So you want to cut, burn, or poison the cancer. But essentially the mainstay of treatment is your wide resection of the tumor with like complete getting negative margins. And then treatment is usually like based on risk stratification. So in pediatrics, mostly we have the children's oncology group, and we had like a non-rhabdomyosarcoma ARST-032 study in which we basically did a risk stratification approach to treatment approach. So you classified patients as like low, intermediate, or high risk, depending on whether the tumor was resectable, whether there were any metastases, what grade of the tumor, and like the size, whether it was like more or less than 5 centimeters. So for the lower risk patients, you can pretty much get away with just surgery alone and then observe them. But with both epithelioid sarcoma and synovial sarcoma, we know that they have a very high local recurrence rate, as well as metastatic rate. And so we end up needing systemic therapy in the form of either radiation therapy or chemotherapy. Epithelioid sarcoma is usually chemo-resistant, but synovial sarcoma is relatively chemosensitive. For the most part, we employ ifosfamide doxorubicin as our pediatric regimen. But I think the adults tend to favor gemcitabine docetaxel for their epithelioid sarcoma patients.
Across the oncology space, precision medicine is really becoming just more and more alluring, more exciting. So could you discuss the approval of tazemetostat for patients with epithelioid sarcoma and sort of what has the impact been in this space?
We're now in the era where we're learning more about the genetic and epigenetic drivers of the tumorigenesis. So epithelioid sarcoma is characterized by the loss of INI1, SMARCB1 mutation. So INI1 is an important component of the SWI-SNF transcription complex. Basically, when you have an INI1 loss, it leads to an opposed activity of EZH2. So this is an epigenetic modifier. Tazemetostat is a potent selective inhibitor of the EZH2 with both preclinical and clinical studies, which have shown that it has efficacy in all the cancers expressing the INI1 loss. So tazemetostat specifically for epithelioid sarcoma was FDA approved in Jan 2020 because of the phase 2 study that was performed, which looked at 62 patients with INI1 negative epithelioid sarcomas, and then 26% patients showed disease control at 32 weeks with that.
immunotherapy is also extremely exciting throughout the oncology space, but what is the story with immunotherapy in these malignancies specifically?
That's an evolving landscape. There are ongoing trials with the use of checkpoint inhibitors in INI-1 negative tumors in both children and young adults. For synovial sarcoma specifically, we know the characteristic translocation of chromosome X with chromosome 18. It leads to the SSX-SS18 fusion protein, and that has a high expression of the NY-ESO-1 antigen, and that's seen in like about 85 to 90% of the cancers. This is being treated with the use of genetically engineered T cells as well as dendritic cell vaccines. The results of the phase one study with the adoptive cellular therapy with the NY-ESO-1 T cells was just discussed at the CTOS meeting, and they talked about promising results in patients with advanced synovial sarcomas who had high NY-ESO-1 expression and the use of lymphodepleting regimens.
How does the treatment paradigm and treatment selection really differ between pediatric to adult patient populations, and what sort of considerations need to be taken into account when treating children with these malignancies versus adults?
There are no head-to-head comparisons of treatments for adults and pediatric patients. There are subtle differences in the treatment doses and the regimens that are preferred, but most of this is driven by like the tolerance or the toxicity profile. As I mentioned, adults prefer like GemTox for treating the frontline epithelial sarcomas, while we tend to favor IFOS and doxorubicin. I guess a thing to keep in mind in pediatrics is the long-term effect from some of these treatments. So the risk of secondary malignancies, as well as like neurocognitive decline with radiation therapy, all of that is very well known. And this limits the use of high doses or its use altogether in our very, very young population. On the other hand, adults, like they really cannot tolerate like really the high doses of chemo that we end up giving to some of our kids because they can have acute toxicity from it, as well as most of the adults do have like baseline comorbidities, such as like a poor cardiac function or kidney function. There is a difference in the sort of the treatment that peds or the adult patients get.
We closed out the night with Gina Z. D'Amato, MD, an associate professor and assistant director of clinical research at Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Miami Health System. TGCT is a rare disease, so could you provide a bit of insight into the condition and the risk factors that it really poses to patients who have it?
TGCT, as I said, is rare. About the incidence, we believe, is probably 43 for every million patients, annual incidence. It can occur in females and males, but slight predominance in females, and average age is 30. Usually the age range is about 25 to 40, but again, it could affect anybody. And what can happen is that it occurs around the joints, usually around the knee or the hands, and patients can have a lot of pain, a lot of swelling, and difficulty with range of motion.
Should a patient develop this condition, what is the primary treatment for patients?
So the primary treatment is surgery, and the patient should seek out a orthopedic oncologist that is experienced in treating this condition. So the surgery usually involves a removal of the tumor with negative margins, as well as a synovectomy, which is basically removal of the synovium.
Of course, we saw the approval of pexidartinib for the patients with TGCT in August 2019. So could you speak a little bit to how this agent is being utilized in the space and what patients are eligible to receive it?
This drug is approved for adult patients with TGCT that either have recurrence after surgery or are not amenable to surgery. And right now it's being explored on clinical trials for children, but right now it's for adult patients. Also, they need to have the diffuse type. And so the patients that we're mostly treating are patients that have had one or two surgeries and maybe have tried some other treatments before this drug became FDA approved. We are also, you know, looking at possibly, you know, exploring it in the what we call neoadjuvant setting, meaning giving it up front prior to surgery, but that's not the FDA approved indication.
What does the safety of pexidartinib kind of look like? And are there any nuances to treating patients with this agent?
Like any treatment, you know, every drug has potential side effects. The side effects are usually manageable, but the main one that we really have to look out for is the potential hepatotoxicity. The FDA has mandated, which I agree with, that we use a very strict protocol when we're prescribing the treatment using the REMS program. So we have to have patients sign up for this program, and physicians who prescribe it also have to sign up for the program. Once a patient's prescribed the drug and begins it, they need to get weekly labs looking at their liver enzymes, also looking at blood counts for the first 8 weeks, then after that, every other week, and then after 3 months of that rigorous testing, then they're pretty much in the clear and they just need to get labs every 3 months. It's still potentially can happen, but usually it's within those first 3 months that we would see the elevated liver enzymes. Other potential side effects, you can get some lightening of the skin and hair, some fatigue. I haven't really seen much nausea, but most of the other potential side effects, we have medications that can counteract those effects.
So beyond pexidartinib and surgery, are there other treatment options for these patients, or are those mainly the two that we rely on?
There have been a couple of, before pexidartinib came out, imatinib and nilotinib have been explored, and that is, you know, those are potential options. And then we do have some exciting new drugs that are in development. One is called DCC-3014. It's an oral medication that also targets the CSF1 receptor. A unique way that kind of really binds to the receptor and doesn't allow it to be reversed. And so we do have a phase 2 clinical trial ongoing right now. It's a multi-center international trial of that drug, and that's very exciting. There's also another compound called cabrilizumab, and it's a CSF1 receptor antibody. And the phase one study was very promising, and the phase two study is currently closed to enrollment. There is also another drug as well, amactizumab, that is also going to be a clinical trial, phase two clinical trial going to be opening as well. So very promising, the monoclonal antibodies, amactizumab and cabrilizumab are IV with the DCC-3014 is oral, but all the preliminary data are promising in all those compounds. So very exciting for the future of our patients.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive on Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and institutional perspectives in cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive on Air.